Morning.
Morning.
We're close to noon. Well, for you, it's almost 10:30.
It is 10:30.
Yeah, it
no,
is.
Almost about it.
Almost about it. I must be in the time zone where you're a few minutes short. One of my clocks here says 8:29. The other one says 8:30. I guess I should look at my phone.
Yeah.
Get GPS time.
There you go. That's most accurate.
So I've been running an experiment this last couple weeks. I've been trying to read a couple of comics as they come out, because I don't do that. I always binge later, after it's been out for a while.
Yeah.
And it's not working out too well for me.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I just don't enjoy them as much. It's weird.
You think that you need a large amount of story to enjoy it?
Well, in the case of one, yes. Well, maybe both. I'm doing two events. Well, I don't know if they're events or... I'm doing Powers of X, House of X, and then Absolute Carnage that way. In the terms of Absolute Carnage, I'm not sure it would be any better. Like, it's pretty much what I expected it to be.
Yeah.
And I've been reading a lot of Venom. Like, I did the Adopt a Character this year, and Venom, I've read like an omnibus and a lot of, probably 100 issues of Venom. So I know a lot.
Adopt a Character, is that something you just made up, or what is that?
Well, Collected Comics Library does an Adopt a Character, and this year I did Venom. So I read a lot of Venom, and I've kind of stuck with it. It's an interesting concept. Every year you kind of like pick a character, and you say, I'm going to learn a little bit more about that character.
Mm-hmm.
And you read as much as you can. I mean, it could be 4 issues or it could be 100 issues, but that's what the concept of it is about.
That's actually something you sign up for on their site and stuff?
No, it's more informal.
Yeah, it's just something they talk about.
I mean, you could
recommend.
You could go to their site and do their Adopt a Character. They have a thread there on their what is that? Slack channel. And you could you could post on there if you choose to.
I
like it as an interesting concept because it vests you in it. For one thing, it gives you like a commitment and a goal to like read as much, and then you could pick a character that you're not so fond of or you want to learn more about and you think it would change your opinion. You could experiment with things a little bit, different eras of it. And I don't know, it's kind of fun. But the Hickman stuff, man, I just don't I find it polarizing to read it in a weekly format because it's so big.
Yeah, it doesn't
he's taking
really
baby
seem like the
steps.
Best choice.
He's taking like baby steps, so it doesn't seem like it's going very far.
Yeah. Yeah, that doesn't seem like the best choice for one to keep up with, like with monthly breaks in between the issues.
Yeah.
Or even 2 weeks. Like Hickman seems like a good choice for the way you normally read.
Yeah, binge. Yeah, because and I'm finding like more entertainment in the prose, which is very weird for me. Because he'll like have, have standard comics, and then he'll have like a two thing where he's like explaining some kind of science fiction fact or something like that, or a fact of the X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
I find those more interesting than the actual story, which is weird for me because I'm not a prose guy, but it's like reading little factoids.
Yeah, maybe because it's more a contained idea you can just absorb in that one setting instead of trying to follow. I mean, from what I've read of his stuff, I remember reading his Avengers stuff. There's lots of little threads and ideas that take a long time to develop. So
That's why I think it was stupid for me to choose his piece, because
Right.
I would have learned my lesson through Avengers, because I started it and I was doing it like this and I dropped it. I actually dropped the title. So I dropped Avengers. I said, I'm not enjoying this at all.
Yeah.
And then one Christmas, I took my Marvel codes and I just loaded them up all on my iPad and I binged it and I'm like, holy crap, this is so awesome. I had to go buy all the rest of the issues. So it's not the, it was the way I was consuming it that was forming my opinion. And I think in general, I like to read things at my own, like when I'm in the mood and like optimize my entertainment.
Yeah, well, you pretty much know that about yourself by this point.
Yeah, I can't read like Rob. That if I would be an angry fan, I think. I would
I would
not
think.
like things as much as I do. I can guarantee
Yeah.
that.
Yeah, I feel like if you were doing that experiment, that you probably would do best with DC, if anything.
Yeah,
With something from
I should have done it.
Maybe.
Like, I should have just picked up Batman or something, you know, instead of like, oh, it's Hickman. But I wanted to do Hickman because I know everybody's reading it, and I just wanted to.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where all the hype is right now, you know?
Right.
So I was like, I'll pick this. And then I wasn't even planning on doing Absolute Carnage, but I was like, you know what? Historically, Carnage and Venom issues are expensive. And if I'm going to miss this and then go back to get it, they're going to be like $10 an issue. When I mean expensive, I just mean double digits. They always seem to go up for some reason. It's bizarre. Those Venom minis are expensive. Like, even though I read most of it in Omnibus, I've tried to pick up some singles, and they're like $10, $20, $30, some of them.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was... I'm not hating it. I just think it was a bad idea to choose the books I did. But I'm gonna finish it. I'm gonna stick with it. I'm gonna, because it's like 6 issues, of, well, 12 issues total between the two of them.
Oh, really? That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know where you're coming from, though. You kind of wanna. There's a appeal in being a part of the conversation that everybody's having.
Yeah,
that's like the big thing that people are talking about. It's like once you get around to it yourself, people are probably not going to be as. You kind of have to go back and look at what people were saying earlier. Earlier.
Yeah,
on,
or just not like not
yeah.
go into the hype.
Right.
Because I ran out of like podcasts to listen to now that they're all, I don't know, a lot of people maybe taking summer breaks and not putting out as much, or all my normal go-tos. So I started listening again to The Comic Book Addict with Mike Pindell, you know, and I've always liked his podcasts and I've kept caught up, but he's like his moods change, and right now he's in like a DVD video thing. So there weren't more any episodes for me to enjoy, so I went back to 2015 and just started listening to old episodes. And two of the books that I'm covering today are because of his podcast. Another one is a speculation thing, like and I picked up this book and I didn't have it. So I picked out some books that I got this week that I think are pretty interesting. And one of them was more like it drew me into like Wikipedia and like trying to find out more. And I added a bunch of titles to my comic shop because of it. So.
That's not an unusual occurrence
yeah.
for you either.
Yeah, it's not.
Yeah. Well, why don't you jump into one of those then?
All right, well, this one is one that Mike talked about, and what's fascinating about this series is it's a reprint, but it's the first appearance in a reprint, which is, it sounds really weird, but Marvel decided to do it for a reason. And it's the first appearance of Dr. Druid, and it appears in Weird Wonder Tales number 19. And the reason it's his first appearance and it's a reprint is his original name was Dr. Droom. And
Oh, okay.
he preceded Doctor Strange, and even Stan Lee said that he would have probably not created Doctor Strange if he would have remembered he did Doctor Droom. And it's really fascinating because it looks like Steve Ditko pencils. But the art is drawn by Jack Kirby, inked by Ditko. So that's also a fascinating thing because I'm such a Jack Kirby fan.
Yeah.
Not as much as a Ditko fan, but I'm starting to become more appreciative of Ditko. A matter of fact, I just supported a Kickstarter, which is a 4-year correspondence between this author and Steve Ditko, and he's kind of a recluse. So
Right.
I'm sort of interested in just reading aspects of what happened in this correspondence. But this tale is the first appearance of Dr. Druid. They essentially had an editor, and everywhere Dr. Droom appeared, they put Druid because they did not want it to start sound. It sounded too much like Dr. Doom, you know.
Yeah.
And this guy preceded Dr. Doom, but since that time, Dr. Doom came out. He became popular, so they made Dr. Druid. And his template is similar to Doctor Strange. He's a physician, a scholar, a psychiatrist, an author. And he's there with his colleagues, and his colleagues are talking about like a Tibetan monk, you know, a lama that's out in the mountains, and he's asking for medical assistance, and none of them want to go. You know, like I got patients here. Why would I want to travel around the world? Blah blah blah. I got this practice. I'm busy. And he kind of hears this and says, I'm sort of interested in this. So he kind of goes through these trials. In the mountains of the, you know, walk through fire, fight like a half ape. He has to get past the half ape, half lion, which is very weird. And then he gets to the monk and he says, "Oh, you know, I'm here to give you medical assistance." And his assistant says, "Well, we can't pay you." And he goes, "Well, that's kind of shitty. You know, you ask for medical assistance and then you don't want to pay me, but I'll cure you anyway because it's my oath." And he goes, the monk says, "Well, I'm not sick." So he's like, "Well, why did you call me here for all this?" And he says, "Well, I want to pass on my mystic arts." And that's how it ended, you know. And he had like 4 issues in Amazing Adventures Volume 2, which are reprinted in Weird Wonder Tales. I'm gonna go for the reprints, of course, because the other ones are a lot more expensive because they're Golden Age books. You know, they're pre Fantastic Four. So I liked it. I liked it a lot. And all I remember of Druid is during the Avengers years, he just came across as really creepy to me. Like he just seemed weird.
Yeah.
Like sexually weird. I don't know. He just made mannerisms and did things that were like bizarre. And because of this, I ordered a couple of things from my comic shop. One of them I didn't know existed. It was a Druid by Warren Ellis, and this one really, and Leonardo Manco, which I'm really interested in picking up. It was a 4-issue from 1995 because these guys have worked together in the past, and they did Hellstorm, which is one of my favorite characters, Son of Satan. So I was like, wow, they did that. And then it turned me on to a book called Marvel Universe. And issues 1 through 3 focus on the Invaders, but 4 through 7 have Monster Hunters, and they sort of retcon his origin into the Monster Hunters. And then there's a John Byrne title where he appears in this issue 2 of The Lost Generation, and it's written and drawn by John Byrne, and I didn't know this thing existed. So I don't know, there's a lot of learning that I was like really interested in. And then it has, to top it off, it has the first appearance of Groot, which I think I've already talked about, but I reread it anyway. It's such a good story. I just, because he's not heroic in this. He's a monster, and he wants to take these people off the planet so they can be studied. And the guy who defeats him is a biologist. He's a scientist. And he decides to take him out with termites. I just thought it was cool. And then the third story in this, I've never read before. It's called The Hypnotist. And this was absolutely fantastic. It's a material originally presented in Astonishing Tales number 47. And this story is about this guy that's real skittish. Like, he's afraid of his own shadow, and he sees an ad for a doctor, and it's a hypnotist to make him feel self-confident and get rid of his fears. But he didn't know he was a hypnotist. And he gets there, and the guy hypnotizes him. And he gets into a skirmish at a bar, and while he's under hypnosis, he punches the heck out of this guy that's trying to take advantage of him or take a seat. And the hypnotist looks at him and is like, wow, this guy's got, like, reflexes of a boxer. So he starts promoting him as a boxer while he's under hypnosis. And he's going, like, he fights, like, 10 fights and gets all the way to the championship and wins while under hypnosis. And then the guy that he beat wants a rematch. And this time the doctor's like, I'm going to make millions off of this because I'm going to bet against the guy, my own boxer. You know, I'm going to put money on the odds because the odds were all in his boxer's favor. He says, like, oh, I'm going to put all of them on the guy who's going to compete against him because I'm not going to hypnotize him this time. And it backfired because he told him he's not putting him under hypnosis and then he's dropping him as an agent. And he got so pissed that he just went out there and boxed with his own self-confidence and beat the crap out of the guy. So the promoter or the hypnotist lost a fortune. So it was a pretty cool story. And I think this has a Jack Kirby cover on Weird Wonder Tales because it looks very Kirby, but I can't see it on the credits at all. Usually you see his credit.
So it was one of those reprints where is it kind of like a facsimile one or?
No, it's a 30-cent edition when they were reprinting. Matter of fact, I've never heard of this title, Weird Wonder Tales, but it's reprints of Astonishing Tales and a lot of their monster books. Pre-Fantastic Four. So they collected, like, Amazing Adventures, Astonishing Tales, and the one that Groot was in, Tales to Astonish, in this one collected edition. It's 30 cents. But it was very interesting. Like, I didn't know about the Dr. Druid, Dr. Droom thing until I listened to the podcast, and I said, oh, that's interesting. And the other thing that I found fascinating was it was Kirby drawn with Ditko inks. So I like that sounds like I want to buy this thing. And it led me down a rabbit hole.
go figure.
Yeah. Weird Wonder Tales number 19.
Interesting. Yeah, that I think was Dr. Druid. I know him from the Avengers too. So was he? As far as I know, he was a character they didn't really do a whole lot with for a while, and then that's when they sort of picked him up again, was with the Avengers.
Didn't he come like shortly after, like when you got into the Avengers, like with the mansion invasion, where they hospitalized Hercules?
Yeah,
I think it was a couple years later than that.
Yep. Yeah, that's kind of what I associate him with anyway.
Yeah.
Cool. Alright. Well, let me just pull up something here.
Are you getting it off of your iPad?
Yep.
Yep. Is it Marvel Unlimited?
Nope. My other usual, which is Hoopla.
Oh.
So, DC put out a trade of the 90s Black Lightning series.
Oh, yeah. That's great.
I can't remember. Did you talk about this?
I don't know what series. I talked about, but I read the whole thing. I read all of Volume 1. There's a Volume 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the issues, if I remember correctly, contained an issue that was in that Comics Cavalcade, or we know how they canceled a lot of books, an unpublished piece.
Yeah, well, that would have been the original.
Yeah, the original series.
Original series. This is the 90s one that didn't last very long.
Oh, you're talking about the Tony Isabella the 90s one. Yeah, I didn't know. No, I haven't reread this one.
Yeah, I can't remember. I know you've talked about Black Lightning on the podcast, but well,
yeah, at least, not this one in particular.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is interesting because they just reprinted this. It contains Black Lightning issue 1 through 13 and a story from the DCU Holiday Bash number 2. So these are comics from 94, 90, and 95. And I think the Holiday Bash was 97, but there's a foreword from Tony Isabella about this opportunity that he had to revisit the character because he was the writer of he's the creator, or at least co-creator of the character. And originally, and then, you know, he was asked by Dick Giordano to write a new series, and it sounds like he did a ton of research, and he decided to set the series in Cleveland, which is his hometown. It's never specifically called Cleveland in the comic. That's what he based it on. And Jefferson Pierce is operating in an area of the city called the Brick City, which is also an actual neighborhood apparently in Cleveland. The foreword was really interesting because he talks about the research he did for the book and traditional research, like going through newspapers and magazines, and but also he did a lot of communication and like conversations with people in the neighborhood in Cleveland that he was basing it on. And he wrote 8 issues of it, and then a new editor came in and decided to replace him on the book. And so it lasted till issue 13 and got canceled. So all of that is in this volume,
What do you
but
mean he decided to? Oh, he got replaced before issue 13.
Yes, he wrote 1 through 8, and then a new editor came on, and he just says a new editor came on board and wanted his own writer. It's not as simple as that, but I won't bog this forward down with a story best told elsewhere. Yeah, it basically it lasted so 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 5 more issues, and then the book was canceled.
That editor might have been Pat Gary or something to that effect, because there's a Carrie Kowalski that's listed as an editor, but she was there since the earlier issues. So that might be this guy.
Yeah, I read this morning what not the TV series. I read the I think it was an Australian writer that was brought on. I was looking up the publishing history this morning.
DeVries.
Yeah, Dave DeVries.
DeVries, yeah.
So,
I didn't even know that. Like I've read this a long time ago and I've never revisited it. I read it when it was coming off the shelf and I never realized there was a transition. I always thought the whole thing was Tony Isabella. So when you said that, I was like, "What?"
yeah.
Yeah, that's weird.
Actually, I just followed a link on a Wikipedia. It took me to a web archive of Newsarama forums where Tony Isabella says, "I did not leave my second Black Lightning series of my own choice. I was fired over 6 weeks before the first issue was released. The day I turned in my script for what would have been the 9th issue on the title, the editor who fired me, the absolute worst editor with whom I have ever worked, wanted to bring in his own writer. Apparently, this was part of his plan to create his own power base at DC Comics, which worked so well that he was let go about a year later." So, yeah, it doesn't sound like
A successful move.
a successful move or a good move, or a comfortable situation.
Especially being the creator too. It's a little bit
Yeah.
different. It's a little bit different if you're like working on Batman, right? And then they say, "Oh, we're switching creative teams." But when you're working on your own creation, and at this point, I think he's the only one that sort of worked on it, 'cause I think he worked on the when it went to Adventure Comics and the dollar format, I think he had those issues too.
Yeah, I mean, the only, you had in between these two series, you had Mike W. Barr using the character for a long time in The Outsiders, but not not as a solo series. But now I'm curious. I'm like flipping ahead in this volume now because it's making me curious as to who the editor was. Pat Garahey.
Yeah, that's
Isn't that who
what
you
I.
said was?
Yeah.
But that has assistant editor is Carrie Kowalski.
Yeah, and Carrie Kowalski was there at the original part, I think.
Okay, so
So
maybe that's the
I
transition,
think
but
the
Pat Garahey's
transition
the
was
new
to Pat
person.
becoming the main editor and
Yeah.
sort of kicking him off his book.
Yeah. Well, anyway, on a more positive note, issue number one is really good. Isabella talks about in the in the introduction how he was brought in by the showrunner of the CW show, where he spent 6 hours with the writers of the CW show and got to, you know, talk to them, and they asked him questions about like stuff that they had pulled from the comics. Salim Akil, the head director and showrunner of Black Lightning, got Tony Isabella to sign his copy of issue number 5 of this series, which apparently is a really good issue. Tony Isabella says it was, he feels like it's the best script that he's written. Yeah, I guess they found this, the 8 issues he did here, like as an influence on the TV show and stuff. So anyway, issue number 1 sort of sets the scene of like Brick City, and Isabella uses some Go ahead.
I have a question, just because I'm curious, because I know the first story took place in Metropolis. Did they have him transitioning, like, to Brick City, or did it just start off in Brick City?
It just starts off, probably because maybe like enough time had passed.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't really feel like a need to do a transition since you had quite a few years in between. I don't know if like maybe in subsequent issues some of that history is addressed, but I think he's trying to establish the, like, the new status quo, and like for new readers not get bogged down too much in like past continuity, you know. He has a different costume here, like he's kind of, they kind of took him back later on to something more similar to his older one, but he doesn't really have a mask, like, but his eyes glow, kind of serves the like same purpose of covering them with like a domino style mask. And he's still wears the blue, but he's got the red and red underneath the yellow lightning bolt V on the top. But Isabella uses the technique of having news reports and stuff like that and going on in the background to give you some of the context of the city, and specifically Brick City itself, with which is a like a poor, predominantly black neighborhood, and issues with public housing and stuff like that are being discussed, we're introduced to Black Lightning, and he's getting ready to go out, and he, over the first few pages, he takes out a drug den, like, well, not really, well, a drug manufacturing spot. This is kind of like his main target. There's a group called BWR, Brothers Who Rule, who are becoming pretty predominant in the drug trade in the neighborhood. So it seems like one of his main goals is, at least throughout this issue, is to take them down. Meanwhile, we also get introduced to the city's mayor, who's receiving reports from his lackeys that that he's got a cape in his city, and he's not happy with it. He's not happy with the whole idea of that seems kind of like one of his main concerns. It's just that he doesn't want a mask, actually, is what he calls it. says, "I'm not sharing headlines with some 2-bit Superman." He's concerned that, you know, with the example of Gotham City, they haven't had a repeat mayor since the 70s. So it's kind of like bad for, he feels like it's bad for his career to have a superhero on the streets. And then we get to see a little bit of Jefferson's day-to-day life. There's an elderly woman, Mrs. Henderson, who they kind of have a mutual friendship in that he takes her to the grocery shopping, but she helps him pick out what to buy, kind of. He might just be saying this so that to cover the fact that he's helping her out. Him being a bachelor and whatnot, she can help him eat healthier and stuff. But she also seems to be wanting to hook him up with her niece. So after he's saying goodbye to her and stuff, there's a cargo's flying by, catches attention, and then we're taken inside the car and we see that it's a man and a woman. The woman's driving and the man's telling her to let him drive, because, I mean, they're both wasted on crack, but he feels like she's worse off than he is, and she's like, yeah, right, it's my car and stuff like that. And Jefferson can see that this is a problem in the making, and so he goes rushing after the car, trying to catch up with them. And meanwhile, inside the car, they're fighting and not paying attention to what they're doing, and a woman is crossing the street with her 2 kids, and it happens off panel, but they hit the family crossing the street. The long and short of it is that the woman gets seriously injured. Her daughter gets hurt, but her young son gets killed. I was pretty surprised that it was a surprising moment. So Jefferson catches up, you know, just as a civilian self, and they're trying to help the lady. She's wondering about her kids, and they tell her that they're okay, even though, you know, the boy is already gone. So it's kind of like, I wouldn't be surprised if this was based on a real story, given all the research that Isabella did, and, you know, I think he wanted to inject a lot of like real stories that he heard and read about and talked to people. He says, this is in the introduction, there's even stuff that he decided not to put in because it was too rough.
Current events, or
more like it's he says it's still stuff that he still has nightmares about and he's never written about. We get a little bit more background. You know, as usual, Black Lightning, he's not your young teenage superhero. He's 39. He's talking about his goals, and what he's...
That's actually pretty cool, because
what he wants to accomplish.
They took that element into the TV show. They made him an older individual.
Yeah. I as you know, like, I'm pretty burnt out on most like superhero media.
Yeah.
TV and movies and stuff, but like after reading this issue and also that aspect of it, that like I think like the actor that plays Black Lightning is almost 50.
Yeah.
Like that actually, like a superhero that's actually at least the actor that's actually older than me, that makes me kind of interested in watching the show.
Yeah, plus you like the legacy aspects of it, like his daughters and stuff, so they put that in the show as well. Yeah.
So Sunday morning, he's coming out of church, and Mrs. Henderson is there, and he meets the niece that she's been talking about, and it's Gail Harris. He seems pretty impressed with her. And she, him, after he leaves, she says he's the talk of Carver High, Olympic star, Wayne Foundation recipient, and totally unattached. Miss Henderson said, "Child, all men need a lot of work." But so he says, "Yeah, he'll be there for dinner, but he might be a little late." She says, "Well, dinner's at 6, whether you're there or not." But he has the thing he wants to take care of, and the last thing for the issue is that he gets some information from one of his informants, and he wants to basically take out the brothers group, their main headquarters, where and so like there's a bunch of them that are playing poker, and he walks in, he drops a stick of dynamite on the table where they're playing dynamite. So they freak out and start running, and at first a few of them try to fight, but he's like, "You got 5 minutes to get out of here." And they try to call his bluff, because they've got $200,000 in cash, coke and name brand appliances stashed there, and a bunch of guys that are ready to take him out. But he's like, "Well, I've got enough high explosives in your basement to blow you all to Mars. So make your choice." And they decided to hightail it out of there. And he just follows them out. Has this superhero moment where he just kind of walks out of the place. A bunch of people from the neighborhood are standing around to watch. And he uses his powers to ignite the dynamite, after telling everybody to stand back because he hasn't done this before. And we get a nice like full page splash of the place exploding. And this is kind of his step up into like the newspapers or whatever in the city, because one of the guys asks him his name, and he says Black Lightning, and the guy says, "Sort of obvious." Black Lightning, huh? Maybe it'll grow on me. But yeah, it ends with the mayor flipping through the channels, and yeah, here you go, Mike. It says one of the first. So he flips through like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. He's flipping through like back and forth between several news reports. And one of them says appeared in Metropolis several. And another says worked with the Batman, former member of the Outsiders. But basically the idea being that everybody on the news is talking about Black Lightning, and the mayor says not in my town. So
it's interesting because it seems like this, I mean, just listening to you talk about it, it seems like this is more influential on the TV version than the original.
Yeah, I mean, he does
with
say
the exception
in the
introduction of Tobias Whale, you know, Tobias Whale and the 100 is, or the 1000 is big in the first volume, so they took elements out of that.
Yeah, and his daughters, the stuff that came from later stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he does say that he, like, one of the, like, things that he's really, like, proud of is that the way that he was able to act as an influence. His work was able to act as an influence on the TV show, and to see some of his ideas and lots of characters that he created, brought to life on the show and stuff. And but yeah, I mean, I thought it was really good. Like, the art. I don't think I really mentioned the artist, but the art by Eddie Newell is really good. Like, it actually reminds me more of like some 80s independent comics, or it also would kind of fit. Like, this book definitely would like not be out of place alongside the Milestone comics.
Yeah, well, he's got, if I remember correctly, it's a darker template, like a,
yeah,
like a Tom Mandrake Spectre world, if you will. It's dark.
Yeah, and I don't mean just like, yeah, it's like stylistically, like some of the art, yeah, that was in the early Milestone comics, like not just, I mean, obviously the fact that it's like African American cast and.
Mm-hmm.
Dealing with like inner city stuff, like
Dennis Cohen, but, type style, or you know,
yeah, yeah. So, but also that aspect. So, yeah, I want to at least like, I would like to check out the rest of the issues that Isabella wrote. At least,
I think it would be interesting to look at the transition too from an historical perspective, to see like, okay, you're going in direction A and you have a plan,
yeah,
and then all of a sudden someone comes in and switches it up a bit. I mean, from an mm-hmm. historical perspective, whether you like it or not, it's still fascinating to
right.
see what historically this guy think he had to do to change the comic. You know what I mean? Like, I would be interested in rereading that just to see.
Yeah, it looks like, I mean, I didn't really recognize, maybe you did, but I didn't really recognize Dave DeVries. But he had written, a decent amount of comics. It seems like he wrote a lot of independent stuff, like First Comics in Malibu. Batman Legends of the Dark Knight, some Star Trek for DC, Eternal Warrior Yearbook for Valiant Comics, Puppet Master for Eternity Comics, Planet of the Apes and Flesh Gordon for Malibu.
Plus you got like a generational thing. Like, I wonder, Tony Isabella was like at his prime in the 70s, like like where he was doing a lot of Marvel work
mm-hmm.
and doing editor work and then writing at DC. And then, I don't know if, like, this other editor came in and wanted to bring his generation of writers in. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to happen a lot.
Yeah. It's like a buddy network.
Like,
I want to try to get my friends in and try to grow something.
Yeah. It seems like maybe in this... In hindsight, that might not have been the best move. And but you know, sometimes you know when you're just making your decisions in the day to day, you're not thinking what's gonna stand the test of time. You're thinking like, what can I do to make my mark on.
Well, not just
company,
Mark,
you know.
But you. I would imagine, let's say you took over a book, right? You would probably want to know, like, how it's been doing prior, right? Because you want the
sure.
book to do good. You're an editor. If the numbers were dropping, you would say, well, maybe I need to try to inject some life in it if I want to keep this title going that, you know... that I got that's under my wing.
Right.
And he's probably looking at like trends that he thinks need to be injected in the book.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so, no, I don't know how it was selling at that time, but
I don't know. I don't think we have numbers going that far back, but It would be interesting. It's close. 1990 something, right? 1996.
Yes. So it was right around that time. I mean, Isabel actually says in the introduction that it was right around the time that started getting like internet reviews of his work.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, my next one is a book I also found out from. I knew about it, I just never bought it. But considering the creative team, I probably should have. Kurt Busiek and Pat Zercher with Bob McLeod Inks. And this is Iron Man: The Iron Age. It's sort of like a deluxe formatted. It's like got a square bound to it, and it had a $5.99 cover price. And what this is, it's pretty unique. This is kind of like the origin story told through the eyes of Pepper Potts, which is very interesting, because she got hired on by Stark's father, and at this time, she saw Tony as, well, he's always been an arrogant asshole, but she sees him like as this kid that just wants to get into women's pants. You know, like he doesn't even care. He's like, let my father run the company, and then he'll come in with like a schematic, and his father will say, "Wow, you're a genius, Tony. Why don't you put some like effort behind doing stuff?" And he just goes about his own business, and it has the death of his parents, like dying in a car accident, which they did take advantage of that in the film, I think. It revamps his origin story a little bit, because with Iron Man, it originally started off in Vietnam, and then they kind of like moved it. They moved it different locations every time, because they can't always have it. I don't even know if it was Vietnam, because it was like 60 something. It was before that.
It was pre-Vietnam.
Yeah, it's
But yeah, they keep
pre-Vietnam.
moving it.
Then they had Vietnam, and then they moved it, and then it became Middle Eastern. And this one, I think it was sort of Middle Eastern. He went to look in at his company, and that's when the shrapnel got in his heart, and then his origin story started. And there's not like a lot of Iron Man action in this. It's more of an historical vision of his company, like how his company started, how it evolved when his parents died, how Tony took over the company and had difficulty because he didn't mind like doing the science behind things, like that's where he enjoyed stuff. But what he really hated was running it. And one time he was doing a presentation, and Pepper saw the errors in his calculations and stuff, and she fixed it. And Tony came in like, "Who changed these numbers?" And you know, blah blah blah. And he basically said, "That's brilliant." He says, "You caught a multi-million dollar error. And you're now promoted. You're now my number one secretary." She was more than a secretary though, 'cause she was studying business and sciences and stuff, so she would recognize when things were wrong, and that's why Tony appreciated her, but didn't appreciate her. He took advantage of her at times when he, you know, would go drinking and stuff and say, "Well, here's all this work, look into it." And poor Pepper Potts was sure enough doing it. And later on, what this story talks about is there's like board members that are trying to take over Stark, and Pepper sort of helps Tony get through that moralistically. Because he at times he's wanting to sell the company, which is what the board wants him to do, and she basically takes him to like some of the workers' families' homes and says, "Look at this family." She says, "You're basically gonna give their jobs away because this is what's going to happen. So she's like moralistically telling him to keep the company, and he decides to keep the company. But they introduce this female character, and she's sort of like, I don't even know if she was just created for this book. She's like a spy. She would be like Spy Smasher in the Iron Man mythos, but she's a female. And she's hired by that organization. She's the Saboteur. And I didn't do enough research to find out if she was just created for this book, like as an early espionage, like try to get into the company and destroy stuff before he can demonstrate them. It seems like weird that they wouldn't have used the Ghost or Spy Smasher or one of those, because they're usually around smashing up Tony's company later on. But she's the main villain in this. And Iron Man, in his gold suit, manages to thwart her actions of trying to sabotage the company. And he does give off a good demonstration to the government and gets some contracts signed. And then this is a 2-issue deluxe formatted book. So the next arc is told through Happy Hogan's eyes. So it'll be interesting.
And who would you say was the creative team on that?
Kurt Busiek and Pat Zercher.
Right.
Both of which I really enjoy.
Yeah. I haven't read anything by Busiek in a while, but I'm like around the early, like around the early 2000s. I remember reading a lot of stuff, like reading his Avengers and reading his Thunderbolt stuff, and like I really like his he's got like a kind of classic 80s style of seeding a lot of subplots and stuff. Like I feel like he's really good at in general, but I think he's really good with team books.
Yeah. He had that run with George Perez, like you said, on Avengers.
Yeah, and, I really like that.
He's well known for his Marvels comic book. Interesting enough, if you think about his career, he likes telling stories from other people's perspectives that are not the superhero himself.
Right, yeah.
Because Marvels was through the reporter. Astro City is always told through somebody else's eyes. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think he likes to play with the heroes, but through the eyes of the normal Joe, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think he did Marvels, and then Astro City is an opportunity for him to do even more of that, but with his own heroes and stuff.
Yeah.
But nice. Yeah, I don't think I had heard of that series.
I had heard about it through solicitations, and I was going to get it, but I was like, when I cut stuff, I always cut Marvel. So
right.
Bless you, Barb. My goodness.
There she goes with that sneezing again.
Yeah.
It's like she's allergic to podcasting.
She's allergic to my podcast. She's allergic to my voice. So she's always sneezing.
That's a bad, bad living arrangement for her.
Yeah. I'd have to be like Black Bolt and not say a word for her not to sneeze.
Yeah.
So what else you got?
All right, well, it's another DC thing, I checked out Shadow of the Bat Volume 4 kind of randomly, but it's all stories written by Alan Grant, with a whole lot of different artists. And the first issue in this volume is Shadow of the Bat 32.
So I take it you're reading these in order?
No.
you just jumped right in.
Yeah, I just jumped right in just to see what would happen. And this is actually Prodigal 2. But I think with Prodigal, it was, sorry.
Is your dog okay?
Yeah, she hears our neighbor outside with his dogs. So she wants to assert her dominance.
That sounded more like a yelpy thing.
than dominance. She sometimes, like, when she gets when she gets real excited about, yeah, she does like a yelpy,
high pitched yelpy
mixed with like a normal bark until she can, if she wants to get out there and curse him out. It's like, this is my neighborhood, bitch. She's fine. But, so yeah, let's see. So yeah, the artist on this one was Brett Blevins. And with Prodigal, I don't really remember reading the whole thing, but, I don't think it was as, I mean, it's the whole thing where the first time that this is post Nightfall and, Dick is Batman, and Tim is, you know, Tim's still Robin as he was prior to this. And, but I don't know that Prodigal was as, like a story from issue to issue as much as it was just like a name for the period of time that, that Dick was Batman. But, because this, I didn't find this issue difficult to jump into or anything.
But it is interesting because it is listed as part two.
Right. So, yeah.
And issue 33 is part six. So it was intertwined.
Yeah.
It seemed like it or not, it was.
Yeah, I know. And I don't know if I think maybe they were just like, because with after Nightfall, I mean, the Bat books were, it was just like one crossover after another.
Mm-hmm.
for a long time. Anyway, I mean, this issue, I mean, I saw that this Shadow of the Bat volume, even though it was volume four, was post Nightfall, and which I'm familiar with. And so I didn't necessarily know that it was going to be Prodigal part two, but I said, well, let's see. Sometimes I'm just curious. It's like, same way if somebody just like picked this up off the spinner rack or something, like what kind of reading experience it would be. And so yeah, it starts out with some guys in an alleyway, and some other dudes pull guns on them from the shadows and say, "No tricks and you won't get hurt." And they say, "Only joking," and they shoot two of the three guys, which turn out to be the bodyguards. This man named Bobby, and excuse me. Yeah, see what Barb is making me do? It's catching. This guy named Bobby, he's escorted by the guys that shot his bodyguards into the back of a limo, and it turns out to be the ventriloquist and Scarface. Bobby says, "The ventriloquist," and Scarface says, "Hey, what is this? Has he suddenly got Star Gillen or something? Talk to me, Goggy. I'm the Gus of this gang." So,
you know, he made a brief appearance in Gotham.
Oh yeah,
Scarface and ventriloquist, and the guy who played him was perfect. I mean, he just nailed him. The way nice. They did that, that was so good.
There you go. Let's relax, Mabel. What comics did you read? Let's calm down.
Does she like that dog or doesn't like it?
Probably doesn't like it. She barks at most other dogs. She. There's a guy that comes sometimes to our neighbor and like does yard work for him and stuff, and he brings a dog with him that's like the dog's super noisy and she's not a big fan of him. But anyways, she came and sat down next to me though. So basically, in ventriloquist is like there's this Bobby. He took over a neighborhood that Scarface and the ventriloquist used to be under control of, and they're making their move to reclaim the territory. And then there's a kind of a subplot that runs throughout the issue where I don't know if it was picked up and stayed in Shadow of the Bat or if it was other prodigal issues or something, but Harvey Dent is I guess post Nightfall Arkham is it's one of the many times Arkham was destroyed and it's being rebuilt, so they've got the Arkham prisoners mixed in with the regular prisoners, and that's where Two-Face is at, and he's got to go to court for the results of his psychiatric evaluation. So that's kind of like a subplot that goes through the issue. Meanwhile, at Gotham Manor, Dick and Tim are talking. Dick is cleaning. It's Alfred. They don't know where Alfred's at. Whether he's like on vacation or what he's doing. So Alfred's not there either. So Dick is picking up the slack and doing his own cleaning while Tim's standing there eating a banana. So they're just kind of discussing the current situation where what's going on, and until Dick says, "Bruce told me a story once. Two philosophers talked all day, and the mess was still there the next morning." And he throws his broom at Tim. In other words, like, stop standing there and help me clean. So the ventriloquist continues to move in on, like, he gets the information that he needs from this Bobby guy, and who works for. He actually is works for a guy named Vetch. The Vetch is the guy that's moving in on his territory, and once he's got his information, he throws him out of the car down a cliff. What he ends up doing is he replaces a whole bunch of Vetch's supply. He captured his distributor and he cut his heroin with strychnine. So there's junkies all over this the territory, getting sick and dying when they shoot up. In the typical interaction, like Ventriloquist is horrified by like everything that Scarface is doing. So then Dick and Tim suit up to do their nightly work. They check in with the computer, and there's the news report about all the the addicts, the heroin addicts getting killed, the suspected contaminated heroin. Nick knows that that territory was is been Vetch's turf for a while, and that Vetch isn't the sort that would kill his own customers, and basically destroy his money supply. It's kind of convenient, but they ask the computer, who would do that? And the computer brings up a picture of a ventriloquist and Scarface. And I guess, I don't know if it's because it's post-crisis and stuff, but like Dick, neither Dick or Tim is familiar with ventriloquist. Dick is a ventriloquist and his dummy. I've obviously been out of Gotham too long. So we also have like a page with Commissioner Gordon and Harvey Bullock. It's just kind of a status quo establishing kind of like page, because Gordon talks about, or, you know, there's a caption with from Gordon's perspective where he muses on the fact that this is the kind of time where he would have like called on Batman, but he doesn't know who post Nightfall with all the stuff with Jean-Paul Valley and stuff. He doesn't really know who is in the costume. So he's not going to be, he's not going to be doing that. So Dick and Tim arrive outside the Ventriloquist's Club, which is closed up at the moment, but that's where he's planning on having a meeting with Vetch. And they, Batman and Robin, they see a whole lot of mob dudes show up. And they basically get right in the thick of like a gunfight between the two groups. Blevins and Grant do a good job of kind of like establishing the fact that these two are going headfirst into a gunfight, you know, without their own weapon, at least their own guns. A nice couple panels where you see this is Dick Batman. You know, his moves are pretty acrobatic, which is a nice touch. He gets his hands on one of the guys and threatens him. I'm a vigilante. That means I can do whatever I want to. And as they're flying away, or, you know, roping away, Tim says, "Nice bluff. Jean-Paul would have just beaten it out of them." And Dick says, "That's why he lost the job." So, end of the issue is the stuff, is the meat between Ventriloquist and Vetch's people. And basically, throughout the issue, Scarface keeps using his corkscrew to threaten people, and Vetch is like, "But you're just a dummy," and Scarface tells him that he goes into a whole spiel about how he was made out of the wood of a gallows, and eventually Vetch gives in, and Batman and Robin come crashing through the window as they're completing their meeting, and Batman goes after Ventriloquist. Ventriloquist is like, and one of his like henchmen are climbing down a ladder, and Dick gets a hold of the Ventriloquist, and Scarface just says, "You give up too easy, you galdy lug, throw me, throw me." And so the Ventriloquist lets go of Scarface, and the his like henchman catches him, and so they tie up the Ventriloquist, and Tim says, "You know, we've got the mastermind, the dummy isn't going to matter much," but the captions say that, you know, this the new Batman should be satisfied, but he feels like there's something that they should be worried about. But the ending's kind of funny. There's the henchman. He doesn't seem like he's too bright, but apparently the ventriloquist gave him strict instructions of what to do if this ever happened, and so he's going to like this safety deposit box, and he's unlocking, and he's thinking like it's probably passports and emergency cash and detailed plans for running the organization while I figure out how to break him out of jail. And then he opens it up and there's just a book, and it's How to Throw Your Voice. So I thought that was a clever touch. And then there's just a final page to continue to set up the two-face thing, where he's making the decision where he could what to do. And you know, he flips his coin, it comes up with the side that's crossed out. So he's going to create anarchy. Yeah, it was a decent issue. I mean,
I like that villain. He's one of my favorites. I like
which
him
one?
A lot. Ventriloquist.
Yeah.
Which, I guess it's two. Scarface and Ventriloquist.
Yeah, they're an interesting pair. There was like, he does make Scarface does make a comment about like, you know, he's berating Ventriloquist for how he spends time and like how he was messing around with Sacco. And that was like something that happened, and I remember that happened in Nightfall, was that he was like, he didn't have Scarface, so he was like, he had a sock on his hand, and he was just like, he was using that. So I don't know how in between like he got Scarface back, but it was funny that was mentioned.
Bye, Barb. She's going to get her hair cut.
She's tired of sneezing.
Yeah. Tired of sneezing. She needs to get away from my voice.
Yeah.
It's contagious. It causes you to sneeze, too.
Yeah, apparently.
All right. So my last book is going to be quick. It's Curse of Spawn number 12. It is the first appearance. Well, it's not the first appearance. It's the first full appearance of Jessica Priest. And Jessica Priest is a character that appeared in the movie. It's a character that appeared in the spot, essentially, of Chapel, because interesting, her name is Priest and Chapel was Chapel because, you know, they have like a religious tone to it, but Chapel was a Rob Liefeld character, and McFarlane didn't want to use the Liefeld character, so created Jessica Priest. And she supposedly, I don't know if this is just a speculator fact, but is going to be She-Spawn in issue 102. So that's where the hype is. And I didn't own this book before. Wanted to see it. She actually has her own action figure, too, because I did some research, looked up her action figure. She's not a good person. And it starts off very early as a child, as she sort of burned her house down. She wanted to roast marshmallows, and her parents wouldn't let her roast marshmallows. So she essentially just burned her parents to a crisp and burned the whole house down, and then had her marshmallows. So when the firefighters arrive, she's there eating marshmallows. And then you cut to the current time, which I don't remember what year this was, but this was the year that the Spawn movie hit, the first one. Actually, there's only one. So it's the live action one, not the HBO animated series, but it's around that time because the animated series was available on VHS. I don't know if DVDs were around at this time.
Yeah, it looks like it was 1997.
Yeah. And so it cuts to her taking out the Republican Guard, and she's vicious, man. She's just slaughtering people over everywhere, and she starts a war between Israel and the Middle East. And then the scene cuts to her swimming with Jason Wynn, and if you follow Spawn, you know Jason Wynn is a bad guy in the Spawn universe, a bad business guy. And she works for him, essentially. And she's going on another mission in the Amazon where she has to search for these two scientists. And the two scientists that she's searching for, she's supposed to get there, get the scientists, and then blow up the plant that they're working in. And it seems like they're ready for her. Like, she was set up. She gets there, and then the scientists are ready to kill her. So it's an interesting story. The thing I found fascinating is I don't remember the name Dwayne Turner very much, but man, does he have like a McFarlane style to it, his art. He's like mimicking him very closely. A matter of fact, if it wasn't for the credits, I would say it was either Capullo or McFarlane drawing this. So, and the story is written by Alan McElroy, and I think at this time Spawn was just blowing up, so he actually had like Hellspawn, this title Spawn, maybe Salmon Twitch, I don't know. There was a lot of titles going on in the Spawn universe. There was all the toys taking off, all the cups and the mugs and all the merchandising was taking off because of the movie. I read some of the letters pages, and I can't remember the exact box office opening, but it was like 22 million and it came in second. And they were a little upset with it, but they made a positive spin on it. So I think it performed below expectations. And
Yeah.
that's probably why we didn't see a sequel.
Yeah, most likely.
That's probably when he was raking in the most butt. You had the Spawn and then the HBO animated series, which had two releases. They released the HBO series as rated R, and then the regular series, there was a PG-13 version released on a videotape. So it was
Yeah, I don't think
interesting
I've
because
ever
I don't
seen it.
remember her at all.
It looks, I don't think I've ever seen the movie. It looks like she was in the movie.
Yeah,
And
she
that's
had her own
why.
action figure spawned from the movie too.
Yeah.
Get it,
And that's why the
Spawned.
whole, like, nice.
I don't actually own the Spawn movie either. I gotta rectify that. I own the Spawn animated TV show, but not the movie.
Yeah, I only have one other thing that's also quick. For whatever reason, Archie put, like, on Hoopla most of the time, like, it's all collections. And which works out good because you can usually, like, it's through library and you only have like a limited amount of checkouts per month. And it's usually like not like a, like in this case, I can check out 10 things a month. Because I think the library like gets charged per item people check out. It's probably not a lot, but they have to put a limit on it because, you know, they have to have a budget and stuff. So normally, like, it's weird to me that like some publishers will put single issues on here because it seems like you want more bang for your buck, so to speak. But just for the hell of it, I know Archie tends to do that. I mean, they put collections on there too, but they also put individual issues, and they put like a ton of older stuff on there. And so I checked out an issue of Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and this is issue 62. So this is from her like 70s, early 80s series. And the cover, is on the beach, and this is a 50 cent issue. And Aunt Hilda and the other, I forget her name, the other aunt, are like in the background, just which one of these lifeguards insulted Sabrina, and Hilda says, "Can't you guess?" And there's three lifeguards, and two of them are human, and one of them is frog shaped. But yeah, as typical Archie comic from then, there's like several stories. The first one is called New Deal. I think most of these are written by Frank Doyle with art by Stan Gee. And you know, she's got her like boyfriend or on and off again, Harvey, and in this first story, Harvey's says that he can do magic tricks, and he messes it up, but before he can see that he messes it up, like, he presents, you know, like, "Here's your card." Sabrina zaps it and changes it to what it should have been. And Aunt Hilda doesn't really like Harvey. She's like, "Why'd you do that?" And Sabrina says, "I don't want to hurt his feelings. He's so proud of it. He's so proud of what he's able to do." So he's like, "I'm going to go show other people my tricks." And Sabrina says, "I don't know. Are you sure you should do that?" So he goes out and he tries to show his skills to some other kids, and they're like laughing at him because he keeps screwing up. So Sabrina catches up, and she's hiding behind a tree, and basically, you know, she starts using her magic so that he does do it right. And but then she like goes to the point that she changes all the cards to the right thing, and you know, he just like, she goes overboard, and then later he says he quit doing magic because he got so good at it he scared himself. Then the next story is like called Wild Blue Yonder, and it's kind of similar in that like Harvey again is like doing something. In this case, like, he's got a remote control plane, and him and this other boy Leroy are gonna have a fly off of their remote control planes, and Leroy shows up, and they're like, "Well, we gotta inspect each other's planes." And Leroy is, when he's looking at Harvey's plane, to supposedly make sure that he doesn't have any illegal boosters on it, he puts a wad of chewing gum on it in a certain spot so that it'll have trouble flying. And yeah, so sure enough, like, that's what happened. And once it crashes, he goes and looks at it. He finds the chewing gum, and so Sabrina says, "Well, I'd like to see them both fly together." And so, because she's pissed at Leroy, and so kind of similar to the last story, like, she ends up taking control of both planes, and both of them, like, "My controls aren't responding." And then, like, Harvey's plane starts like shooting bullets at Leroy's plane, and Leroy's pissed and yelling at Harvey because he's like, "Your plane's armed," and he's like, and Harvey's like, "No, it's not." And like, "Well, why? How's it shooting down my plane?" And in the background, like, Leroy's plane is crashing into the earth and on fire and stuff. And then Harvey's plane comes flying at Leroy and starts chasing him away. So Sabrina gets her revenge. Then the next story, it's what inspired the cover. Sabrina's at the beach. It doesn't have anything to do with lifeguards, though. In this case, there's a couple guys who show up and piss her off because they bring a loud radio and set it up right next to her and disturb her peace, or she's just trying to read a book. And they put the radio down, and then they're going to go swim. She's like, why don't you turn your radio off while you're gone? He's like, yeah, right. It's like, it's going to wear it out if you keep turning it on and off. And so so when one of them comes back to get the beach ball, she switches it so that the guy thinks that the radio is the beach ball and vice versa. So he takes the radio back and goes to and throws that to his friend instead, and it goes right in the ocean. He's like, you creep, that cost me $80. And he's like, I could have swore that was your ball. And so that kind of thing, she then she does the same thing when turns the ball into a custard pie, and so that the other guy, so basically, and then they end up getting in a fight, and she's happy. And then the final story is called The Cure. This one has a different artist, Bob Bowling, but, you know, it looks pretty much the same because they kind of kept it to, like, a house style with all the Archie stories. And this one, it involves Aunt Hilda. The doctor, a doctor is seeing Aunt Hilda, and that he says that Aunt Hilda's problems are mostly in her mind, so they're sending over a psychiatrist friend. And Sabrina says, I don't know if that's a good idea, not that I want to tell you your business, but, and the doctor dismisses it. And so, the psychiatrist shows up and tries to hypnotize Aunt Hilda. He tells her to act like a monkey. So she actually turns herself into a monkey and starts bouncing around the room, and this obviously scares the hell out of him, and he just goes, like, flying out of the house. And the last panel is, like, the psychiatrist at another psychiatrist, like, you want to see a psychiatrist, but you're a psychiatrist. It's, like, I don't know if this story would really have, like, would go over well today, because, like, the language that they use, like, is not really, like, would not really be accepted about, like, the mentally ill today. Like, he says, the psychiatrist says, yeah, I am a psychiatrist, so I know a nut when I see one.
And not politically correct, anyway.
Right, yeah. I mean, and the whole idea, like, I think a lot of psychiatrists do actually see other psychiatrists because they believe in the practice, but... And, yeah, I actually... I thought it was kind of cool. They actually, it ends with a Josie and the Pussycats hostess ad. And I just thought it was cool that was actually included. I guess, you know, they were able to because it involves their characters. Mm-hmm. None of the other ads are in there, of course. But so I grabbed that. Just something a little different to, you know, break up the DC superheroes.
Sounds like you enjoyed it.
Yeah,
at least from a humor perspective.
Yeah, it's silly. I mean, it makes you chuckle a little bit.
So, what is the? This was on Hoopla. What was the reading experience like? Is it like Comixology and that you can zoom in, or is it like reading a PDF?
I think it's pretty similar to Comixology. I think you can
panel by panel.
Yeah, you can zoom in, do panel by panel.
How do you read it?
I read page by page.
Do you have a big iPad or?
It's not. I think it's an Android tablet, but I think it's like 8 inches. Which I like. That's actually like It makes it's a little so it's a little it's a bit smaller than a comic book page, but I kind of like that better than it being blown up bigger than a comic book page.
Yeah.
And I don't know, the 8-inch tablet I just find convenient for carrying around
Carrying
and
around, yeah.
reading than like a big iPad. Plus, it's cheaper.
Is that pretty much what you do now as Hoopla? Like, you don't do the. Do you still have Marvel Unlimited, or do you just do Hoopla?
My Unlimited isn't active right now, no, because I just wouldn't be using it a lot. But since that's something you can just like resubscribe to if you feel like, I let it lapse because I wasn't currently
Reading
using
from
it a
it.
lot. Yeah, but yeah, Hoopla's convenient. I mean, it's not good if like I get into a mood where I want to read a lot of like stuff in a certain order. Like I was doing with Marvel Unlimited at times where I go back and forth between the different titles. But if I just want to read, it's pretty much it's mostly trades. So, it's if you're not too picky about what you get, I mean, most of the because it's I think because it's like a library only thing, and publishers know that people are like. It's not unlimited, you know, you can only read a certain amount per month. Like a lot of the publishers are putting stuff on there at like when they get released. not when comic shops get them, but when bookstores do. And you know, so that's when libraries would get the paper copies
Well, I
also.
think that's where their growth area is in Scholastic and in libraries. Like, I don't think comics are growing in the direct market.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it makes sense that they're trying to release things quicker.
Yeah, and I mean it gets in front of eyeballs, you know, like if same way if like it's on the shelf at a library, like someone can try something, you know, maybe it'll bring in readers that'll, you know, use their 10 credits or whatever like that a month, and then if they really get into comics, that's not gonna like, if you read a lot of comics, that's not gonna like be enough for you in a month, you know.
It's 10 credits that per month. Like, you can't. I thought it was 10 things you can check out at one time.
It's 10 credits a month.
Which means you can get 10 trades a month.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's just through Hoopla. I mean, if you want to, like most libraries, if you're going to check out paper copies of stuff, like you can check out tons, you know, tons per month. Like there's no monthly limit. It's just like how many you have out at a time, which is still like a ton. So, you know, people could go that route
So I imagine the
and check
library
out
is paying
trades.
like a rental fee to the publisher
Yeah,
of some sort.
that's the way that Hoopla works. Like, the library has to pay. That's why, like, you won't see all libraries having it because, like, it's more expensive, and like, you have to pay anytime someone checks out an item. That's why they limit the amount that each person can. And then Hoopla must, yeah, pay the publishers based on what gets checked out. So if like I'm checking out all DC stuff, like mostly, then I assume that like a portion of that money is going to Hoopla, and then a portion of that money is going to DC, and I'm paying that through my taxes, you know, but not, you know, directly out of my pocket.
Yeah, and you paid Archie too.
Yeah, a little bit, I guess. But yeah, so it's cool. It's not like so yeah, not like it's not unlimited, so it's not gonna be someone it's not gonna satisfy if somebody's reading a ton of comics on a monthly basis. It's not gonna you're not gonna be able to read all your comics that way, but it's a decent way to try stuff, especially since like it gets new stuff and
Maybe it's a better way to like
Image and
explore
most of the publishers out there.
yeah, the independent stuff.
Yeah, because you're like a lot of, you're not going to see like a lot of the like a lot of the unlimited. I mean, you have your Marvel Unlimited, which you have to wait for a certain amount of time, and then you have like Comixology Unlimited is like unlimited, but it's only like certain things, and it's usually only like it's not. It might be the first few books of a title or something, because it's really kind of wanting you to get hooked on something and then buy the rest of the volumes.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of podcasters are using it now.
Yeah, I mean, it's
Even
there.
CCL, Collected Comics Library, they tend to read stuff from Hoopla.
Yeah, it's one of those things, if all you need is a library card, if
Yeah,
your
you're,
library
well,
has it
you're,
available,
like you're
so why
right. I
not?
mean, it's one way to take advantage of your taxes that you're paying, right?
Yeah, and you know, you read a lot of comics. You read like your 10 per month on there, and then you read other stuff other ways, whether that's paper or
Well, I mean,
Comixology.
if you subscribe to Hoopla, which is free because you're already paying it in your taxes, and then you subscribe to maybe Marvel Unlimited and DC Universe, you have quite a library to choose from.
Oh yeah. Yeah, if you're doing if you supplement it with other something else, like
Yeah.
depending on what works for you with your taste, you know. Like if you're really into Marvel or DC, you could subscribe to one of those services, and then Hoopla you could use to check out stuff from other publishers if you're mostly gonna read a lot of DC or Marvel.
I use the DC Universe quite a bit because of it gives me and Kyle for DC Spotlight a common place where we could choose something to read or
Yeah, that makes
watch.
sense.
I just watched the Shazam Spotlight documentary. It was really good. I enjoyed it.
Cool.
What I didn't realize is I always thought that DC bought the rights in 70 after that lawsuit, like they sort of bought the rights, but I didn't realize in the 70s when that Shazam comic was coming out, they were licensing it from Fawcett. Yeah, so there's some good factoids in there that I didn't quite realize.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good that they have that platform now, 'cause like I'm saying like a lot today.
There's a
They
lot of comics on there now.
yeah, and there's a they've made a lot of documentaries for as DVD extras for their animated original animated movies and stuff that it's good that they have somewhere to put those documentaries as well, not just the animated shows or animated movies. Because otherwise, those documentaries will just kind of get lost and buried on those DVDs.
Yeah. And they premiere like Hush and like stuff that just came out. So yeah, they have the I was like, what is this? Like on the first ad that when you log in, they have like Aquaman showing up and like I don't remember an Aquaman cartoon, but it's the really old one. So I've never seen it. I'd be interested in watching it just to see what it's like.
Yeah, Rob texted us. Wasn't that what he said that he was watching?
Oh, he's watching the Aquaman.
Well, and he texted us earlier. Yeah,
Oh,
he
I
said,
probably didn't catch that text. I saw that he was going out and with his parents or later in the day, and then going shopping and stuff.
yeah, after you said sounds fun, he said that he was watching the 1967 Aquaman cartoon on DC Universe.
Yeah, I think he's enjoying it. Like he's definitely using his membership because we got him on that Manhunter, and
Oh yeah, he was talking about that.
yeah, he's getting his money's worth. I think it's good value. I definitely am getting it. getting my money's worth per month on there. The Marvel Unlimited too. I feel like I read at least 6 books a month, which is justifies the cost of what I'm paying. Plus, I like the fact that if I'm missing an issue, it usually has it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could just
You don't
go
have to
read it.
wait.
I don't have to wait to try to track it down. I could just go read it.
Yeah. And
Yeah.
'cause then by like by the time it actually came in the mail, you'd probably be on to something else.
Yeah. Alrighty, well, I think we could wrap this up. You can reach @MythMakingETC on the Twitters. That's Chris and me. Mike @MikeMyersBrunch, and Rob is @RobKrieger. And this has been an episode of the Retrocast, found on the Geek Brunch podcast website. And also, you can click on the like button on the Facebook page under Geek Brunch Podcast. And thanks for joining me, Chris. I didn't think we could do it, and I wanted to because I'm gone next weekend. So, but I'm glad we were able to record.
Definitely. I feel like it's been a while
Yep. And
since you and I did anyway. One of these
yeah.
days we'll get all three of us on again, but it's good that
Flexible
we have
things, yeah.
flexibility there.
Keep the
So.
wheels, the train moving.
Yeah.
All right, well, take it easy and have a good Sunday.
All right, you too.
All right, bye.
Bye.